Three black churches burned in Louisiana are a reminder that the past does not stay in the past.
Domestic white terrorists are the greatest domestic terrorist threat to American life today. And so we have to call something what it is, and that's white terror.
On this takeaway for April 15th, we discuss the history of attacking black churches and the problem of domestic terrorism. Also on the show, when insulin prices soar, patients face tough choices.
Drug companies like to say that there's nothing bad in our secret deals. This is all good. We're all doing our best to bring the prices down. My answer to that is, if there's nothing bad in there, open up the deals.
And the Trump administration's transgender military ban is in effect. We'll hear from an active duty service member working to reverse the change.
This is everyone's country.
All right, let's do this. When three historically black churches were burned in Louisiana over 10 days, communities across the state were reminded of the long shadow of racial terror that is part of our nation's history.
These churches really around the country have really operated as the center of black life. And so when you're thinking about a way to terrorize the black community, one of the first and principal institutions that people are going to seek to terrorize, to destroy, historically have been the black church.
There was Dr. Ibram X. Kendi. More from him later. While no one was hurt in the attacks, a 21-year-old white man was arrested and charged with arson for the church burnings.
I don't know what this young man's motive was. I don't know what was in his heart, but I can say it cannot be justified or rationalized. These were evil acts. But let me be clear about this. Hate is not a Louisiana value.
Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards there. The church burnings are the latest examples of high-profile attacks on houses of worship, like the mass shootings at a Pittsburgh synagogue last fall and a historic black church in South Carolina in 2015. According to the FBI, hate crimes are on the rise in the United States for the third consecutive year. I have two guests to help us understand the history of acts of hate brought against houses of worship. Dr. Randall Maurice Jelks is author of Faith and Struggle in the Lives of Four African Americans and professor at University of Kansas. And Dr. Ibram X. Kendi is the author of Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America, and the director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University. Dr. Kendi starts by addressing the fact that authorities have said they can't say whether racism played a role in the crimes.
They're looking for obvious sort of intent. They're looking for someone leaving a statement that says, I hate black people or I hate this particular group. And anything short of that, they're going to question whether it is a racist act. And I think that's indicative of how we understand race in general in this country and racism. Instead of assessing whether racism is involved as a result of the outcome, we look for intent. And when we can't find intent, we question whether racism is the cause.
Dr. Jelks, you grew up in Louisiana. Tell us about what these parishes are like.
Well, the particular parish, St. Landry's Parish, is the home of Zydeco music. It's a home of a large African-American Catholic population as well as Baptist population. It's a interesting and intriguing mixture of Arcadians, or what we call Cajuns, in that region. And it certainly was the home of slavery, American slavery, all of those parishes where my grandparents are from nearby. All of those were where enslaved Americans dwelled, lived, grew up side by side with poor whites in their community.
And Dr. Jelks, a lot of these churches have long histories in their community. What role have these churches played historically for the community?
Well, historically for the community, before there was other things to do, the internet, television, radio, black churches were the center of cultural life and the center of political life, and still play that role in a lesser degree, I would argue, today, but still very central to that. politics would go through those churches as a way of communicating, as a way of helping people form their moral ideology in the face of ongoing racism in Louisiana in particular.
Dr. Kendi, the burning of black churches is not a new phenomenon in the United States. Sadly, it has a long and painful and violent history in our country. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how that specific act of terror has impacted our country's history.
Well, I think first and foremost, to sort of add to what Professor Jug said, these churches, I think not only in Louisiana, but really around the country, black churches have really operated as the center of black life, and so in a community. And so when you're thinking about a way to terrorize the black community, a black local community, one of the first and principal institutions that people are going to seek to terrorize, to destroy, to set fire to, historically have been the black church. And so it's indicative or symbolic in a way of burning down the community. Now, of course, in many of these places, these communities have been resilient and they seek to rebuild themselves through the rebuilding of those churches.
Also, partly, I want to take a little bit of a look at the media coverage on this because, Dr. Kendi, you wrote earlier this month that the media, essentially after the New Zealand mosque attacks, failed to identify white terrorism for what it is. Are we seeing that now?
I don't think so. And I think that is a problem. And I think this is a larger issue. It is the FBI, local policing forces, even the Justice Department is no longer able to deny, and in some cases is coming out stating that domestic white terrorists are the greatest domestic terrorist threat to American life today. People who are mass murdering people, who are burning down institutions, so we have to call something what it is, and that's white terror. And I see the reason why I say white terror is because these people are typically terrorizing on behalf of whiteness, a superior whiteness that they believe is under attack. And this is, if we don't simply call white terrorism what it is, then in a way we're continuing to shrug it under a rug as it continues to harm and terrorize people.
Dr. Jelks, some of this is being portrayed in the media, at least, and in comments by the governor specifically, as a relic of a bygone era or a, quote, very dark past. Is it in our past? Because it doesn't, it seems to still be very present.
Well, that makes me chuckle. I think this is a part of a larger pattern, not just in Louisiana, elsewhere. I think that there is real puffed up fear led by white elites. I'm going to argue that they are led by white elites that make working class to poor white people fear that they are somehow going to be overtaken by the mass black and brown hordes. And this triggers racial violence. This happened at the turn of the 20th century as well. Lynchings were around property issues, and somehow that poor whites and working class whites would be removed. And this was often promoted by the elites in the name of their own interests. And I can't help but see what comes out of the public policies in our nation's capital, the public policies, particularly in Louisiana, and policing policies playing the same kind of role.
Dr. Kendi, I want to bring you back in here because I want to take a look at some of the reaction from the press conference in St. Landry Parish last Thursday, specifically in reaction to the person who committed these crimes. Let's take a listen to what the governor of Louisiana, John Bel Edwards, had to say.
And by the way, let's pray for Mr. Matthews,
yes,
and his family, that God will create in him, in all of us, but in him at this time, a clean heart.
Yes.
We'll also take a listen to St. Landry Sheriff Bobby Goodrow talking about his relationship with the suspect's father, who is one of his deputies.
He was shocked and hurt, as any father would be. And my heart went out to him yesterday.
We often don't hear that type of reaction if the suspect were a person of color. Am I wrong here?
I don't think you're wrong. And I think that I think we should figure out a way to be empathetic, even when someone has committed tragedies and atrocities and mass murders. At the same time, it is patently obvious that when a black person does something far less hurtful to a community there, or even people of color in general, there's far less empathy. There's a rush to judgment. There's a rush to claim someone as engaged in an act of terror. There's a guilt till proven innocent, and so I think that is why when we have these white suspects, suddenly they become human, and when there are black suspects, they are demonized as predators. And I think that we need to figure out a way to treat black people as if they're human, and even figure out ways to condemn very strongly white terror.
I agree with Dr. Kendi in full. This person did a terrorist act, no matter how much his parents might love him. And he did this terrorist act against people whose relations love them, too. And that's the unfortunate side of those comments and not being hard-headed. No one said those forgiving and kind words when a young black man was shot at a convenience store in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And that's the hypocrisy of the whole thing.
Dr. Kendi, would you like to weigh in on that?
Yeah, and I think that at some point we as a nation are going to have to realize, and I should say specifically people whose racist ideas, color, crime, and terror, black and brown, are going to have to realize that their lives are in danger by people who are most likely to be in danger as it relates to terrorism by people who happen to be white. Or we're going to have to say that people of color are not American, because people only imagine that people of color are being targeted by these people when in fact it's white people too.
Dr. Ibram X. Kendi is the author of Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America, and the director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University. Dr. Kendi, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show.
And Dr. Randall Maurice Jelks is author of Faith and Struggle in the Lives of Four African Americans and professor at the University of Kansas. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Jelks.
Thank you for having me.
Nearly 1 in 10 Americans has diabetes. That's more than 30 million people, many who rely on insulin to survive. When insulin was patented a century ago, it sold for $1 a vial. And that's because the scientists who discovered it wanted to keep the drug affordable. But today, a single vial of insulin can cost as much as $1,500. How did we get here? That's what lawmakers wanted to know in a hearing last week. Here's what Illinois Democratic Representative Jan Schakowsky said to executives from the top three pharmaceutical companies who make insulin.
We know that a huge number of people are not taking the insulin that they need because they can't afford it. So then they get sick, they get sicker, and maybe they die because of it. I don't know how you people sleep at night.
But for all the outrage, even temporary price reductions haven't stuck. Robin Feldman is a law professor at UC Hastings and the author of Drugs, Money, and Secret Handshakes, The Unstoppable Growth of Prescription Drug Prices.
So the price of insulin has risen enormously in the past decade. You have also seen improvements in the drug itself, new methods of delivery, new ways to try to use insulin that have certain value. The question is, is that value worth what people are paying for it? The initial invention of the core chemical for insulin happened more than 100 years ago. And if you look at the top insulin makers throughout the country, they have managed to pile protections onto their drugs over and over again. So some of them have piled as many as 55 protections. That's what blocks cheaper drugs from competing and getting into the market.
What about a generic option for insulin? I mean, isn't insulin at this point, given the percentage of Americans that have type 1 or type 2 diabetes, can't this be considered a medication that needs a generic option?
Generics are the best hope for competition in the market. That's how the system is supposed to be designed. We expect the pharmaceutical companies to get a handsome reward when they invent something, but after a period of time, generics should come in and drive the price down. If the deals block generics from getting traction with any of the various middle players, their drugs aren't going to get on the shelves. It's no good if you develop a drug and it's not being offered to people.
Let's talk a little bit about pharmacy benefit managers, or otherwise known as PBMs. Who are they, and how do they affect the cost of insulin?
Well, PBMs are the middle players. They're supposed to be working on behalf of the health plan. That is, they're supposed to be working for you and me, the health plan's clients. And their job is to negotiate discounts with the drug companies, and then also to help the plan set the terms on which you and I can access the drugs and how much we will get reimbursed for that. So the system is supposed to be set up so that the PBM middle players are getting a good deal, but that's not how it's happened. Instead, the drug companies have turned this system on its head and figured out how to give lots of very attractive payments to the middle players in exchange for middle players preferencing the more expensive drugs.
Obviously, we're talking about this given the congressional hearings that are happening right now about insulin pricing. What's happened so far there? I mean, has Congress learned anything from these hearings?
My sense in both was that the executives escaped pretty much unscathed. It is a complex area. Sometimes the terms they wave in front of senators are 100% accurate and not helpful. The things that are going on, the secret deals, the ways in which this is structured are very bad for consumers and for you and me. Now, the PBMs and the drug companies like to say that there's nothing bad in our secret deals. This is all good. We're all doing our best to bring the prices down. My answer to that is, if there's nothing bad in there, open up the deals. Let the government see them. Let the press see them. If there's nothing behind the curtain, open the curtain.
But is there any federal agency that is charged with limiting or overseeing these drug companies and what they do?
There is no federal agency that does this. And the different federal agencies involved, nobody has the right mandate to get us what we need. So at the Patent and Trademark Office, the question is just, is this different? Not, is this any better? Does it really have therapeutic value? Just, is it different in some way? At the FDA, the question is safety and efficacy. That's a very important question. But they're not asking whether the drugs that are coming out and that we're getting pushed into in this system are actually any better for patients or a good value at all. There's nothing set up to watch out for your interests and mine. I do believe, by the way, that we do markets well in this country, and that a good injection of competition so that drug companies are exposed to market forces would go a long way. But the government can't keep putting its thumb on the scale and helping out the more expensive medications.
Well, how can we expect the government to create policies, or even during these hearings, how can we expect to trust them to make decisions on behalf of Americans versus their own private interests?
It's a difficult question. The pharmaceutical industry is an extraordinarily powerful lobby. Pharma industry spent $270 million last year lobbying, and I believe they have 1.5 lobbyists per member of Congress. That's a lot of power out there. However, so many people are upset and frightened about access to life-saving medications. Their voices may be heard.
We have seen some price reductions from some insulin manufacturers, Robin, so far. Do you expect that others will follow suit?
So I am heartened to see prices come down. The question is, what's going to keep this? What's going to make it long term? A company can decide for public relations views that it would be good to have lower prices right now when the heat is on, and then we'll let them slide up when Congress gets tired of this and goes on to something else.
Robin Feldman is a professor of law at UC Hastings and the author of Drugs, Money, and Secret Handshakes. Thanks for joining us, Robin.
Thank you for having me.
So if you need to use insulin, how much does it cost you every month? If you've seen the price go up, how are you managing?
This is Chay from Redmond, Oregon. The cost of my insulin could almost be a rent payment in a smaller city. I struggle every month to afford it, and sometimes I even have to ration it.
This is Reverend Nan Baker. I live in Dallas, and I've been an insulin-dependent diabetic for 40 years. I know of two people who cut their dosages because they could not afford their insulin. One was hospitalized but recovered. The other had both feet amputated.
Hi, my name's Tony. My wife and I live in Miami, Florida. Her insulin for a 3-month supply had gone from under just $40 or so to about $150.
Give us a call and share your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Hey, you, podcast person, Amy Walter here, host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Every week, I'll take you beyond the headlines for a deeper understanding of how Washington works, who's pulling the levers of power, and how it all impacts you. I hope you'll check it out. Just search for Politics with Amy Walter in your podcast app and subscribe. Happy listening.
This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega.
On Friday, the Trump administration officially barred openly transgender people from enlisting in the military under the gender they identify with. The policy went into effect after the Supreme Court lifted a final district court injunction against the ban last month. And if you thought the ban was already in place, that's because all of this started back on July 26, 2017, in a series of tweets from President Trump.
With my generals and military experts,
please be advised,
the United States government will not accept or allow
transgender people from serving
in any capacity in the U.S. military.
Our military cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs
and disruption that transgender in the military would entail.
Although the president claimed to have made the decision after consulting with his generals and military experts, his tweets reportedly caught several high-ranking officials off guard. Several lawsuits against the policy are still making their way through the courts, but for now, the transgender military ban is a reality.
This is Don't Ask, Don't Tell for transgender troops.
That's Aaron Belkin, the director of the Palm Center, a research institute that studies LGBT military service. After the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in 2011, the Palm Center conducted a study looking at how that change impacted military readiness.
We used 10 different research methodologies, observations with units in the field, interviews with generals and admirals who had predicted the sky would fall, statistical analysis, survey data, to try to figure out if repeal had caused any negative consequences, and we couldn't find any.
Now that transgender service members are once again unable to openly enlist or transition while serving, Belkin says that's likely to create a more hostile work environment for LGBT troops. But the bottom line for Belkin and other LGBT advocates is that this policy change underscores how the Trump administration views transgender people.
The regulations refer to the need to undergo gender transition as a quote-unquote deficiency and classify gender dysphoria along with bedwetting, unbelievably, in a group of congenital and developmental quote-unquote defects. And this is so appalling that the American Medical Association issued scathing statements saying that it is not appropriate for government entities to stigmatize transgender people in this way.
Trans service members are not a detriment to our units. We're not a burden on our medical system. We are completely and 100% deployable, just like any other service member.
Blake Dreeman is an active duty Navy lieutenant commander and president of Service Members, Partners, and Allies for Respect and Tolerance for All.
SPARTA, as it's called, is an advocacy organization focused on transgender military service. And he began his gender transition in 2013, several years before transgender people were first allowed to serve openly.
I was stationed on a submarine at the time and still had two more deployments under me, and having to do that dual life thing definitely added a bit of stress to my already stressful job, but at the same time took away part of what was holding me back as a complete officer. And so that's what I did. And while I continue to maintain the fact that I don't think anybody knew, there were definitely suspicions, but at the time nobody cared. They cared that they had food on the table and they could fix their stuff, so, and that I could stand watch.
Before you transitioned, you were serving as a woman in the military, and I'm wondering, were there friends, colleagues of yours who were concerned on your behalf for what might happen when you decided to make the choice to transition?
The only people that were concerned really were my parents. My mother was actually more concerned on how it was going to affect my career than my transitioning. My colleagues didn't even notice. I'm the same person that they had beforehand. I mean, I integrated women on submarines, and this wasn't a big deal to them. It was simply another sailor showing up, doing their quals and doing their jobs, and that's exactly what I did.
When the Pentagon was considering a rule change allowing transgender people to serve openly, you were part of those discussions. What were those like?
Well, a lot of it was many of our senior leaders had never met a transgender person, much less a transgender service member. So it was putting forth people who are already transitioning, already doing the job, and showing them and proving to them that we aren't a detriment to anyone's unit cohesion. We're continuing to do the job. It's not something that's going to keep us from deploying. We are still deploying. And so it was destroying those myths and putting the right image in front of people.
When President Trump announced that he was going to ban transgender people from serving openly in the military, what was your initial reaction to that?
Well, my initial reaction was definitely a bit of shock. But at the same time, as the president of SPARTA, I have 800 service members that are looking to me to tell them how to move forward. And so can't stay there very long. So I had to put my initial feelings beside and get to work to making sure that we, rather than defend transgender service, is to just show people what trans service looks like and to make sure that we emphasize that this is about keeping the best and the brightest and not about some sort of social experiment, as much as people would like to say that.
What is the new rule as you understand it? And tell me a little bit about the impact that this will have on transgender service members right now.
So the new rule basically creates two classes of transgender service members. You have the first that come under a grandfather clause, where they will be allowed to continue to complete their transitions and serve in their true genders. And then you have a second group that, while they'll be able to supposedly identify as transgender, they will not be able to serve as their true gender or access that medical care to transition. So the impact becomes, again, somebody going back to living two lives, similar to under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, where people had to hide the fact that they were gay. They could be gay, but they couldn't tell anybody that they were gay. This, in general, someone can tell you that they're transgender, but they can't transition. So instead of hiding their life, they're forcing them to live in a situation that is treatable.
How are people understanding the policy change, which just started on Friday?
Well, right now we're going to see a lot of confusion because it creates two different sections of people. There's going to be some confusion regarding with commanders, with who's exempt and who's not, and whether or not that exemption actually exists, and those types of things. So I expect the next 90 to 120 days that we'll be getting a lot of phone calls with commanders moving forward with disciplinary or administrative actions based on their misunderstanding of the policy. I hope that's not the case, but I do believe that that will be the case simply because it does create confusion.
One of our producers spoke to Aaron Belkin of the Palm Center, who called this new policy Don't Ask, Don't Tell for transgender troops. And he also explained how a policy like this creates a hostile work environment for transgender service members who aren't publicly out. Let's take a listen to what Aaron had to say.
The problem when you have a ban in effect is that if someone is harassed, they can't say, hey, that's unprofessional conduct, because everybody knows that if the perpetrator decides to make an issue of it, they can go to the commander and say, I think this person is gay, or I think this person is transgender. And then the victim of the harassment is subject to discipline and even subject to being fired from the military.
Blake, what are your thoughts on that?
I have a little bit of a different take in the fact that the DOD EO policies haven't changed. Gender identity for DOD is still a covered aspect of the harassment thing. So they haven't changed that. Now, whether or not anyone's going to pay attention to that or has paid attention to it so far is entirely different. I do think that there will be situations where someone will create that hostile work environment and commanders won't want to touch it. It's not a matter of them not thinking that equal opportunity is not covered or doesn't create a hostile work environment, but they're going to consider it a situation where, well, it's better if that person goes away, and that will happen.
Blake, do you expect transgender service members will leave the military because of this ban?
We've already seen some service members reaching out saying that they don't intend to reenlist or they're going to look for a way to get out because they don't want to serve in a military that doesn't support them. And when you have less than 1% of the nation already volunteering, you can't afford to lose the best and the brightest that want to serve their country. So I think that is an impact in and of itself. We're already seeing that recruiting levels are hard to reach. And as I said in other places, this is everyone's country. And the service of our service members needs to reflect that of all of the people who we represent.
Blake Dreeman is an active duty Navy Lieutenant Commander. Thank you, Blake.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.